from a child, this camera and the images and seeing the world in a square frame is more about what do you exclude? What is it in this space that if you only have a frame would tell that story? And what is it you don't need to see? That is who I am. I see things in a frame.
That was Charlotte Bors Christensen. And this is Nordic Portraits. Charlotte Bors Christensen is an award-winning cinematographer and director who made a name for herself internationally for her work on Thomas Vinterberg's 2012 film Jagten, or The Hunt, for which she received the coveted Vulcan Award at the Cannes Film Festival. In recent years, Charlotte has turned her attention to Hollywood, having helmed such high-profile features as A Quiet Place, Molly's Game, The Girl on the Train, The Banker, as well as Denzel Washington's critically acclaimed directorial debut, Fences. Charlotte, welcome to Nordic Portraits.
Thank you.
Charlotte, I wondered if we could start by going back to the mid-1990s.
Whew, that seems so long ago.
Well, obviously, Denmark was about to establish itself on the global cinema map with the Dogma 95 movement. Mm-hmm. But in a parallel world, you were turning 18 and you
received... Yeah, where were I? Thanks for telling me. I wouldn't have remembered, yeah.
Well, you turned 18 and you received a book entitled Masters of Light.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered what that book in hindsight represents to you and the person who gave it to you.
It's very interesting you mentioned that because it truly is the beginning of understanding and, of course, not fully understanding, but just maybe more being aware of the cinematographer's job. And it's a book that actually means everything. I grew up at a farm in a little village called Sverbo, and my dad's a farmer, and he had a couple of other farms that he was selling out. And one of these farms was sold to the most wonderful couple that were in the film business, Vibeke Gad, the Danish film director, and then Hans-Erik Philip, who's a musician or a composer. And they had horses, and I was whatever, 12, 13, and I had horses, and there wasn't a lot of girls in the area that was riding, so Philip became my sort of riding pal. And I remember at that point, I was already sort of interested in my parents' camera, and I would take little photographs, and I would actually make little stories and put them on a piece of paper, and I think he saw those. On all these rides, he was telling me about how he was composing and how he was working with directors, and obviously, I didn't have any interest in this at that point, but I was sort of lectured and I was just quiet writing. I was just happy to have a writing pal, so I was listening to all this. But later on, he sort of saw these photographs and he said, well, you know, there's actually a job where you tell stories with images. And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, what you see in TV or you go to the cinema, there's a person doing that. And Philip was the person who then years later gave me this book, Master of Light, and said, you know, this is an interesting book. It's one of my favorites. And it's a book with a number of, at that point, the most well-known cinematographers still. And it's an interview book. So I read this book and I was just fascinated because I knew nothing about what the job was. I didn't know any cinematographers. But it just, there was something that made a lot of sense. And I think this is a book actually you'd read when you're a little bit older and you know about the job. But I was just fascinated with the way they spoke about this spheric thing that you sort of enter and who you are when you're a cinematographer and not just doing the job technically, but the person you have to be and how you're a leader. And it just touched something that I felt like, this is me. But they were all very experienced, I want to say old men, gray-haired, long beard sort of. And I didn't think more of it until Philip one day said, but there isn't a lot of women doing this job, you know, so maybe you should, I gave you this book, but maybe also consider maybe writing scripts or directing. So it's sort of, I was given this and at the same time, I was like, but you can't have it.
But approaching that book, presumably the personalities that are leading the conversation as cinematographers, but also their references speak a lot to film history. What was your experience of film history at that point?
Very small. you know, my dad's a farmer and my mom's a hairdresser, and there was nobody in the family who sort of had experience in this film business. So I had no connection. And going to the cinemas was sort of like what we did on a birthday once a year, or, you know, we're just an ordinary family that would have recorded at VHS James Bond or Indiana Jones. Remember, we had sort of like a lineup and we made a book with all the numbers, and I'd just review the same VHS tapes again and again and again. So it wasn't sort of a wide knowledge I had to films. It was the very commercial films and Steven Spielberg. And so it was very small. It was more like an internal thing that this book touched, this thing of the leadership of managing images to, in the end, make a story was something completely different than watching films. So I never actually watched a lot of films, which is very interesting.
So when you then studied at the London School of Film and Television, besides the fact that you were coming from regional Denmark into the big city, what surprised you when you arrived there about the study itself?
I think I was a little shocked in how physical it actually is, you know, because reading this book, it was all philosophies and how you sort of manage yourself and how you are a DP and how you represent yourself and what the work is spiritually. So I think I was a little surprised by the fights that you have to go through to actually get to that point where you buy the viewfinder and you're making art. I think every young filmmaker at some point early on sort of realizes this is not just being creative and being a master of light. It's a lot of physical struggles on the way.
And how technical is it?
It's very technical, but I'm not a very technical person. I love the techniques. I love understanding what technique I need to use for a certain project. But I'm not the person who's, you know, looking through every new magazine with new methods or new techniques or new equipment. I'm interested when I need it, but I'm certainly not a tech nerd. However, that's part of what I came to understand is that when you're a cinematographer, you are a leader and you cannot do this job on your own. So the job is also, first and foremost, when you start a movie, is to set your team. And so I was very aware of hiring people who could cover the areas where I wasn't that strong and where I could ask the questions, especially these days when you shoot on digital cameras and it suddenly says like error 6,200, you know, I'll just throw my hands in the air and go like, what? Help. And I'll never come to understand, no matter how much I read, I don't understand what happens in this computer camera. So I make sure to have people I really trust. And I think that's a good leader also to say, well, I need you because I can't do this. And so I love making a full team where everybody is there because I need them and not just because, you know, you got to have somebody who fixes things. It's a collaboration. So I'm interested in the techniques. I love exploring them. I'm good at it when I need it, but I have to study it constantly for new projects.
Of course, you mentioned that initially it was about understanding even the physicality of handling the camera and so forth. You, of course, were an operator on at least the early films. I think, for example, to Submarino, Thomas Vinterberg's 2010 film, which was your breakthrough Danish feature.
Yeah.
Operating, was that more out of necessity than anything else? Or is that something that you just felt more secure in as a cinematographer to be hands-on?
I mean, in the beginning, it's what you do, you know, especially when you're at film school and when you do your first little films, you're hands-on, you operate the camera and you, it's part of the learning curve. Obviously, when you make big movies in the States, especially also in the UK, you could work with an operator. For me, operating was right from the beginning, the essential thing, you know, so it wasn't just a technical thing of like, oh, the camera needs to be panned or whatever. It wasn't a mechanical thing. For me, it's a storytelling process. And so I loved it from the film school years. And it's where I feel I'm actually doing what I need to do. And it's where I see the lighting. Mm. So it sort of became right from the beginning something I love. And I forget everything else when I got that camera in my hand. So it's interesting because I'm not that technical in terms of where's the button to actually record. I do remember a shoot where we were out and the director goes, oh, you know, the birds are flying. And I take this camera and I pan. I'm like, the guys are not around. I'm like, well, shit, I don't know where to turn on the camera. And it was a film camera. So it was like a little switch. I expected there to be a big red reg button, but there wasn't. It was like a little tiny metal switch at the back. And I never realized that they pushed that up and down when we were recording. So just on the spot, everybody was just laughing that the DP didn't know how to turn the camera, but I'm operating. Just to explain, you know, I may not know that much about the cameras, but it is a thing that I have my collaborators to help me with the technical aspects, but the camera is my guitar. You know, I don't sing very well without that guitar. And so when I came to do bigger movies, I couldn't let go. And it is a thing in the States where there's a strong union, and I understand and respect it very much. But I see the lighting from where that lens is. And when I see it on a monitor, which is obviously also where the lens is, it suddenly becomes just a postcard. It's a thing more than being in it. And so the lighting changes when I see it on a screen, whereas when I see it through a film camera or from the camera's perspective in the space. So it's sort of developed to being a key element of cinematography for me when I work. So I continuously operate now.
So you mentioned that you're like a musician that needs a guitar in your hands. To stretch that analogy further, if you were a musician, your big break seemed to be when you started this creative partnership with Thomas Vinterbauer. As mentioned, he was one of obviously the front runners of Dogma with his film Festen. So fast forwarding to the Submarino opportunity, how did that come about?
So I went to the National Film and Television School in London, and so did my, at the time, boyfriend, now husband, Stefan, was also there. And we participated in this competition called the Kodak Awards, and we were first years, and it was actually a second year competition, but we had this idea. And so the tutors were saying, well, you know, maybe we could borrow a camera from the second years if you help them out assisting. And so we did that, and then we had a camera and we went and shot our idea, and then we won the entire thing. The second years were angry with us because, you know, we were only first years, but there's four or five film schools in this competition. It's a big thing, and we won. So we won this little award where we were donated a camera, a 35 millimeter camera, and stock. And so I've always enjoyed writing little scripts, and I'm a terrible writer. And I think I did it in my early career to sort of somehow self-educate, understanding scenes, understanding scripts. And I sort of just imagined something and I wanted to write it down. So I had like a number of short film scripts. And so when we won this award, we thought, well, let's just shoot one of these scripts. And so we handed it out to the directors we wanted to work with, the film school. And they were like, what is this? Does not make any sense. Two kids and what are they doing? And that was the whole point, sort of two kids and two cars and a traffic jam and they fall in love, but they can't talk because the kid that's in the poor car can't take down his window. And so they never get to talk. So there's no dialogue. And it's just a little 10-minute love story and the cars separate, but sort of first love. And it was poorly written. And so they said, we don't get this. It's not interesting. No sex, no guns, no nothing. So we just directed it. And this little short film then won Best Upcoming Director, which was not the point, you know. But anyway, this little short film accidentally lands on Thomas Winterberg's producer, Morten Kaufman's desk, because I'd actually given it to a friend. And so somehow it sort of landed there at a point where he was doing interviews. So it was a little bit of a lucky punch. And Thomas was looking for a film school young DP and wanted to sort of do Submarino in a very low budget and being creative. And so he wanted a young DP. So that was bit of luck, you know, but then you have to live up to it after that.
Well, how was that for you then to have to live up to it? Because what was it like for you to step onto set with someone who's already an established name within the world of cinema and you're recently graduated?
Yeah, that was amazing. I'm the type of person that is, you know, when I did the interview, I just remember I was so scared and it was Thomas Vinterberg and remember my face was red as a, I don't know, and obviously didn't think I was going to get the job because I was so nervous. But I'm also, once I'm past that and I got the job, I also get so excited about the script and the project. So it was an amazing chance. A lot of luck, and there was a lot of hard work in this, but the actual experience was incredible because Thomas was somebody, a well-known, award-winning, famous director, and I was, as you say, just out of film school, nobody. But our vision and the way we see things are very, very similar. So it was an extraordinary thing to work with somebody, you know, famous, but at the same time feeling that we're looking for the same thing. Thomas is also very, like, he took me on and he taught me things, because obviously a lot of the stuff I didn't know about being on set. So he was very generous in terms of taking me on board and sharing his directing and sharing his thoughts and letting me in, which to me, it meant everything, because my first feature film became a continuation of my education at a level that I'm not even sure I can express. At the same time, he was after what I was. So it was a very beautiful relationship, but also one where, like, I would take up an argument for certain things. And so with Thomas, so it didn't feel like, thanks to Thomas, it didn't feel like, you know, I came in as an underdog. He really did what he could to make it an equal relationship. However, you always know when you're on set with somebody who's the same with Denzel Washington. You once in a while, when you go to the toilet and you come back and you see the set from the outside, I had those moments once in a while. I was like, am I really allowed to walk in there and talk to Thomas Vinterberg or Denzel Washington or Aaron Sorkin? And sometimes going to the toilet and returning on set is the moments where you're suddenly going, oh, whoa. But when you're in it, it's a collaboration that is about the story.
So I'm interested about that, because you talk about your vision being very in sync with Thomas, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like your initial meetings with Denzel were quite different around his film Fences. Can you share a little about what that first meeting was like?
With Denzel Washington? Oh, gosh. I think the script came to me as we were finishing Girl on a Train in New York, and my agents called and said, you know, Denzel Washington is making this movie, and it's a play written by August Wilson called Fences. They want to make it for the screen. And Denzel is in town and you're on the list. Do you want to meet? And I was immediately, what? Me? That can't be true. No, I shouldn't meet for that. That's a joke. Like, it's almost that crazy that, yeah, I didn't want to. You know, I was brought up at a farm. I'm Danish. I'm very realistic. I don't believe in the American dream. I was like, what? That's a mistake. No, of course I don't. And they're like, it's not. It's real. And they said, you should meet. He's in town. So I go for this meeting, and I obviously sort of probably imagine a little bit of ticking a box, and next one is probably already waiting outside the door. And, you know, I have 7.5 minutes. But I get to Denzel's flat and the producers are leaving, and he's taking his time to interview me, mainly for a very long time, talking about the story, and so passionate, just really giving it all about what his vision is. And so I'm sort of amazed. I don't get to say much. I'm trying, but he's such an incredibly passionate person when it comes to storytelling that you can't, you know, even though I had prepared some stuff, and I remember halfway through, he sort of stopped and go like, I mean, what do you know about African-American culture? And I was like, well, you know, I'm a Dane from Denmark in Scandinavia, but I know about theater, and this is, you know, we have Ingmar Bergman, and, you know, translating stage to screen, and there's a lot of universal things here. And I suddenly sort of got into it, where he suddenly stepped up and questioned that he spent all his time on this white girl. And it became a very passionate, intense 4-hour meeting. And I remember leaving the flat, you know, I came expecting that there was a queue of DPs outside, and I walked down Fifth Avenue going like, this is never going to work. For that exact reason, you know, wow, he's so passionate and he's a legend and I'm not. So my agents called and were like, what did you say? And I was like, well, I'm sorry. You know, it's just, I got very, he was passionate and I was listening for so long, and then I got passionate, and I said, well, you know, we think he wants you to do the job. And I was like, wow, I can't do that. Just simply scared to enter a relationship where somebody who is truly somebody and somebody who's truly nobody, how are you going to make that work? So for a while, I couldn't see myself doing it, you know, off respect to Denzel and Scott Rudin and other amazing people who were doing this project. And fear of just being a little gray mouse running around trying to live up to other people's expectations and my own. And weeks later, the agents called me and said, so what about this? And I was like, well, I told you, I'm not sure this is for me. I think you should move on. And they say, you're crazy. It's an incredible script and an incredible opportunity. So I think I said, well, could we meet again? And they were like, you want to ask us to call Denzel Washington that you want to meet? And I was like, well, I just want to, you know, how are we going to work this out? And I think I just needed to understand what he thought of that. And so I flew all the way to LA, so nervous, realizing that I asked for this. I'm going to have to start saying something. And on the plane, I was thinking, well, I should just be very honest and say, well, I'm a collaborator and I'm a nobody. And are you a collaborator? I was sitting outside his office for a while and his assistant said, well, Mr. Washington's ready for you. I just remember banging the door open and just being really surprised how big the office was and sort of marching over and shouting in his face, I'm a collaborator. And he just looked at me and went like, who brought you up? And I was like, my parents. And he said, well, somebody, did they not tell you to say hello when you meet people? And sort of gave me a hug. And I said, well, I just came over to say that, you know, how is this going to work? And he said, well, somebody told me you're a very passionate person. And I said, well, somebody told me the same thing about you. And he said, so that's going to be great. You're passionate. I'm passionate. What more can you ask for? And I have to say, it was one of the most incredible experiences I had. And he never broke that. You know, he was passionate and we could disagree about things, but with such focus on the storytelling that there was never a question about all these other things that sometimes can be confusing that may not have to do with the story.
Hmm. How have you evolved as a cinematographer in terms of being able to push your own vision? Because presumably you have a script, you have the director's vision and interpretation of that.
Mm-hmm.
How much is it about serving their vision and how much is it about actually bringing your own perspective to that?
For me, it's both. And so the balance is always different from project to project. So sometimes you need to give more and sometimes you need to stand back. And it's one of the things I wish I'd, you know, that I had been more sensitive to early on in my career. But I think that's also what comes with experience is that you have had a number of relationships where you understand that things are different. But I always knew that for me, it's both. You have to serve the director's vision, but you certainly also have to come with something. Otherwise, I don't want to say just a technician, but otherwise you are a technician that just executes. And as I said to Denzel, I want to collaborate on this. And is that what you want? Or do you want somebody who executes? Because then somebody's better at that than me. I'm not technical. So I want to talk. I want to develop the vision first verbally. And then I communicate these things to my team who are amazing technicians. And so I'm a collaborator who takes from Denzel Washington and distribute it. And then the image becomes everybody's efforts. And I work in a way that in prep, my very first task is to understand the vision because I read the script and I immediately will have my own vision, which I think is okay. But I've learned with the years, like you don't throw that in up front, but you should be aware of it because if somebody asks you, you need to know what you think. So I do read and allow myself to create my own vision. Then you start collaborating with the director and the challenge is, and now I believe and dare to say I'm better at that because I don't have to immediately tell what I read. And so you listen and you understand, okay, they want to make it, you know, the last project I did, the directors, Britenzol, their vision was a European feel and the imperfect is the perfect, not raw, but still with an American sort of cinematic matched into it in certain areas. And you get this umbrella of like, oh, okay. And then your vision can make all that maybe even better. So I think for me, it has to be both. I have to first listen, but then bring what you see, because otherwise, why would they hire me? And directors who has a strong vision, I find also often are more accessible and want your vision more because they can cope with that. And the project becomes better. So yeah, it's a very fine balance and it's a skill, but it's also what it's all about. How much do you serve and or can you serve 100% and still bring yourself into it?
Can you provide a specific example of, let's take Aaron Sorkin, that was his directorial debut as well,
yep.
with Molly's Game, 2017, challenging a director's vision or bringing your own vision to the table? A film like that where I think, my gosh, a lot of locations.
Yeah.
And Sorkin being the master of dialogue, trying to match the cadence that he's writing and being so particular and notorious for needing actors to match what's on the page. I just wondered, could you provide maybe an example of how you were able to impose your own vision on that project or at least challenge Aaron's, for example?
Aaron's vision was not visual. So, and he said that already in the interview. He said, I need somebody to visualize this, but I know what it is. So early on, it became very clear to me that I'm responsible for the visuals, but Aaron is the filmmaker because he understands obviously script writing, but also rhythm to a point that it's very hard to understand because he's a genius in terms of rhythm. And movie making is moving images. And when anything is moving, there is a rhythm. And somebody decides or maybe are not aware that they don't put a rhythm to it. And it just becomes a cut, 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 cut thing without the rhythm. But what Aaron has is that rhythm is written with commas and full stops. And so it was a completely different approach from my perspective. And because he was so honest up front saying, like, I know nothing about lenses. And he's actually said it in an interview recently saying with Molly's Game, he needed somebody to babysit that part. And he said that up front. So I loved that. And the fact that he was honest about it. And I often make those documents. And in this case, it was even more useful because I could show things, visual things. And he could say, oh, I don't like this or that. So you at least get comments. And I was looking for the directions by showing things because then you have something physical to talk about. A postcard or whatever, a shot from the internet or whatever. So the actual choosing a lens was all on me, but Aaron had a very clear direction to the speed of the track, how many cuts, how many shots in a scene. So he said, well, this scene is 27 seconds. The dialogue is going to be cut this way. And I only wanted to cut three times. So you can only make four shots, but two of them could be the same. So maybe we only need two shots. And then it would be on me. So how do you solve this in two shots? And it's like, whoa, okay. But it has to move. So it's like, okay, but it's very far from that table and where you want to start the shot. I mean, that's a very fast track. No, it can't go fast. Okay, but it's 27 seconds and it's that distance physically. So the physics doesn't always correspond to what's written. That's imaginary, right? So that was the biggest challenge was that, well, what you've written doesn't, you can't make that in two shots in 27 seconds and make it slow. I mean, then we have to make more cuts or it will be longer. No, it can't be. You know, so it's so clear in Aaron's head what this scene is, which is another incredible learning experience from my perspective, because I didn't understand, obviously, rhythm at that level. And today when I, you know, when I'm doing a montage with somebody else where it is about moving images and rhythm, I pull what I learned from Aaron out of the backpack and just is grateful because, gosh, I learned a lot. So again, it was a very fruitful experience. It was tricky because we weren't, like with Thomas Vinterberg, we see the same thing. We feel the same thing. We can talk about the same thing. He knows what I know and I understand what he's doing with the actors. So it's a very, we're sort of sitting in the same chair. And with Aaron, we're in two different chairs. But a great experience because he was very open about it and said, this is what you need to do for me. And I'm going to tell you what works and what doesn't. So very different experience. But I did really enjoy making Molly's Game. It was difficult. Well, not because of making it, but because of the type of movie, which is 80% voiceover. And a woman who's a lot of the time watching from the back of the room a game that you don't really want to understand. You don't need to understand. You need to understand what she's seeing. So she's standing still, but it has to be moving. And it's a voiceover. So she's not in a dialogue. So there's no cuts. So the traditional sort of like overs doesn't really work. So in that sense, it was a very challenging project.
You mentioned earlier about collaboration, collaboration, collaboration. Does that extend to the actors and how does that look? I think to something like Fences, where Denzel and Viola Davis are doing their thing as incredible actors. And you have, for example, Rose's monologue, which is now famous. It feels quite almost a little bit spontaneous, the camera movements. I'm sure it's not. But when you have actors that are such strong characters and are so incredibly high caliber, how intimate is that relationship that you have with them? And what do you need to understand about them and how they work in order to get the best out of the scenes?
I love collaborating with actors in the respect that they obviously have a close relationship with the director and their relationship is what I need to understand. But on the side of that, I do have a relationship with the actors and actresses because when you operate, they look for, a lot of them understand camera. So they will look to you for what are you going to do? Because I'm going to do this. And so there will always be a collaboration. And I really reach out and try and make myself accessible for them and express what I have in mind, most often through the director, but sometimes the director is busy and just go like, well, you two figure that out. And so it really is for me as an operating DP, crucial that I have some kind of relationship with the cast. On Fences, it was even more extraordinary because, I mean, Viola Davis with Denzel Washington are just two of the most incredible actors on this planet. And the way Denzel directs not only his technical team, but also his colleagues, actors and actresses, is that nobody gets in the way for the performance. Nobody gets in between the performing actor. So it was planned, but at the same time, all that goes right out the door when we are in that and when Viola Davis is in the moment of performing. If she's extending it or repeating all of a sudden, I just go along. I don't go like, oh, okay, then we need to go back to number one. You know, you just don't do that. So he sort of demanded a very high respect for performance. And obviously he's an actor. So that was just in the whole project. It wasn't even surprising. It was just we do this. So we would plan something, but I often had the Zoom on. So he also gave me the freedom to sort of resize something when I felt something. And for those, Denzel also wanted to go full takes. So some of them were like 7 minutes. And we don't want to do 7 minutes here, 7 minutes there, a little bit wider. It had to be organic to the moment. So it is a little bit, I don't want to say searching, but it is following the performance or trying to be in the moment rather than staging it. So I think you're right in saying it not searching, but it's definitely moving with what Viola was doing. I just want to spend 10 seconds just saying how incredible the two of them are. Viola would be on set. I remember before this now quite famous take, she'd just be quite calm knitting and being on set with all this sort of like lights up and this go there and tracks. And she would, oh, am I in the way? I'm just going to move my stool over here. And she'd be knitting. And then we were ready and like, you want to rehearse? Not really. I'm going to be here and here. And then just going straight into that performance, we were all shocked. So you don't dare to bring technical aspects between moments because she was so respectful to, this is your time to set up and now I'm performing. So I think also cinematography, it's a fine thing to be able to give that space and give the freedom when you need to. And we could do all this planning and have all these amazing ideas, but there is a point where, okay, I'm just going to draw from whatever I can right now and just do the very best. And those moments are what I love the most, when it just is a felt moment.
Yeah, I mean, you can only improvise if the planning has been done well, I presume, if the foundation is there. How meticulous is the planning?
I truly believe that preparation is the key to a good result. And it doesn't matter if you then throw it away in the day. It means that you have thought through and discovered the areas where the cinematography could go or where it shouldn't go, and you've had the chance to communicate properly with the director about it. So it means that when we're out there on the day and the director's busy with the actors or actresses, or I draw from that. I don't have to constantly ask. So preparation allows you to make decisions that are still based on the director's vision. Even though I'm doing it out there, it's based on conversations that I have had. So I draw from all the things that are written down that the director said in certain moments or conversations. So I make this document, you know, so when we have our coffees and I note everything down, anything I think they can express something about a scene, which is not what the shot should be, but a feeling that he or she has, I will note it down. So on the day before I go on set, I'll read all those 10 things about this scene. And they can just be like, oh, something feels airy about it. Or, you know, it's just descriptions. And then I put myself into that so I can make certain decisions on the day. So preparation, even if it isn't a shot list or it isn't a storyboarded scene, it's very specific to me and I know exactly what we're looking for.
Mm. Charlotta, what does genre mean to you in terms of the way that you work within it and perhaps break the rules? I think to something like John Krasinski's A Quiet Place, where obviously you're working within a very well-established genre of the thriller slash horror. Yeah, I'm just curious, now that you have some experience working in various genres, do you see it as a positive thing that viewers have certain expectations, or do you see it as limiting sometimes?
I don't know that it's limiting. I think it's important to sort of respect expectations somehow. A genre is there because it does draw from history, from things that we have developed as human beings. So, you know, somebody said to me when we did A Quiet Place, oh, if you don't know what to do with the camera, a horror movie angle is just wide lens low. And I thought like, oh, okay, so we just do the whole, you know, then it becomes boring. But I understand the feeling that genre means. So an audience is like, if they go to watch a horror movie, they're prepared to be scared. So it's more that respect for what an audience think when they choose to see a horror movie. On the other hand, I don't think genre gets in the way, but especially with A Quiet Place, what was so interesting, and I think we luckily maybe managed to succeed in challenging a genre. And so questioning, it still is a thriller horror because you get scared and you are like, don't make a sound, you know, just don't. I mean, she's giving birth. That's a scary, thrilling moment. So it was written in the script. Those things I didn't have to produce visually. You don't have to make a low angle because it was in the performance and in the story. But I think what was incredible about that project was the opportunity, and John's, this was something he said during a conversation that I sort of picked up, and he didn't mean it at that point as a thing, but he just said it. So this is a good example of how a director's vision truly can come through just a conversation when you have a coffee, but not necessarily sort of answering my question, what do you think this is? But he said it truly is a family portrait, and he just sort of said that, but that came from his true vision. It's a family portrait. That's a very poetic thing. So all of a sudden you go like, okay, what if you match horror, thriller with poetry? So the images, a lot of them are quite poetic. You know, it's like super slow moves and autumn leaves are in the background. And all of a sudden a foot comes into shot. And this relationship between John Krasinski's character and the daughter who's deaf, and this guilt thing, and but truly it is about love and how do we survive. So this poetic family portrait in a horror, thrilling monster movie was just a fascinating combination. And I think in many ways it made that film at that time, it made it something different and was part of why it became so successful. that it sort of felt new. And then the performances are very good. Emily Blunt is probably one of the most amazing actresses I work with. And to hold a portrait in that sense while also performing such scary moments and thrilling moments of giving birth silently or trying. It just was a story that there was a lot of opportunity to explore genre.
Is that something that you actively seek out when looking at a script, the opportunity to try different genres than you're familiar with?
Yeah. Or just to read a stereotype script about something. My nature is always to go, I don't want to change it. I don't need to discover new genres or be seen as a person who, but I think it's interesting, especially nowadays where, I mean, there are so many films and series and, you know, COVID people, that was what they were doing for 3 years, just watching. So they are so educated in a way. And so it's not just about changing it. And unfortunately, I feel what's happening in the business at the moment is what's coming out is sort of challenging itself. So it's like, well, we just got to go faster and it's just got to be more and the monsters need to be even more scary and it just gets more. To me, that's boring and it's a shame because it doesn't challenge it truly. So I think it's interesting to see what can you do? What does this story offer in terms of to put an edge on things rather than just trying to exceed it? And A Quiet Place had that opportunity in the writing and in John Krasinski's idea.
There's an old adage in film that editing is at its best when it's not noticed.
Yeah.
With cinematography.
Same.
I was going to ask, is it a compliment or is it a negative to say that you can see a particular cinematographer's fingerprints on their films?
No, I think that's a compliment. As long as it doesn't take over, especially again, nowadays where there's so much, you'd be grateful if people can recognize because you bring something, because you take the time and the effort to give it a character or a tone that isn't just like the rest. And that's not to offend anybody else at all. But there is a lot of projects that has so little time to be made that, you know, lighting becomes an LED wall on one side. So it becomes just lighting contrast, you know, light one side and dark another side. And then that looks cinematic. But that's not storytelling. That's illuminating. And I don't blame the technicians working on these projects because it's what's demanded from producers and money. And so it's what you can do. But that is a shame because it erased those fingerprints where you can see, well, this show is shot by the master of darkness, you know, or whatever it is. There's so much of it and we have to run so fast that it can be hard for cinematographers to put their fingerprint on things. And I just pray that we'll slow down a little bit and it's quality rather than quantity and that we get back to the craft.
How would you define your own craft or style?
That I hope, I can obviously only say, but that there is a nerve. That it's not about beauty or speed or lighting, but that there is a nerve. And a nerve means feeling, that you feel something from a setup or from a scene because the choices we made is true to the story. I'm very loyal to a script and I'm very loyal to a director. Even if I'm saying things he or she doesn't want to hear, I dare to say it, but I do it truly if I feel it's justified because the director's previously said something, oh, I really want to do this, and all of a sudden it's changed because we don't have time I try to protect their own vision. To stick to that nerve, whether I succeed, I'm not going to answer that, but it's my mission.
It sounds like there's such an intimacy to that relationship with the director. So this dance around, you know, courting each other around whether you should enter a project. Do you sense now that you have a fairly finely tuned radar for whether it is going to be a fruitful relationship?
Yeah. And no. I, you know, I'm not that experienced, but I've had the opportunity to work on a number of projects and each project does teach you something else. What you love or what you want to avoid. And so you do get more educated in terms of sensing those pros and cons. But also I do want to say it's not always obvious, thankfully. So sometimes the story or script draws you more to watch, but it could be an unknown director or, you know, so you don't know still. But I'm not scared of those because I think with experience also comes how to handle those issues. I mean, Fences was truly, and same with The Hunt, just dream projects where every day was a creative process and everybody was working for the same thing and there wasn't personal issues involved from here, there and everywhere. It was a very truly passionate storytelling projects. But it isn't always like that. Doesn't mean it's not a good project. But I think with experience, you also want to get better solving those issues, whether it's your own or it's other people on the crew. There are projects where I'm like, there's absolutely no, I've been there, done that, and I'm not going to do that again. But also, I feel stronger in terms of how to deal with issues.
You mentioned the people management side of things. How would you describe yourself as a leader?
Collaborator. That there has to be a leader, otherwise that's just the structure of how group working relationship works best. And it's proven. Like there's got to be somebody who's leading it. But if that leader is able to be part of the group, just one of the group, and then step out and go like, okay, now it's time that somebody make a decision in a respectful way, I think that's a good leader. You know, so sometimes you want to be in the middle of pulling the rope and we're going to pull it over that middle to win this thing and I'm just pulling with all the others. Or you step out of it and shout for the others to pull harder or give. You know, this is what's really interesting about leadership is every day is not the same and every situation doesn't mean that you have to stand on the highest chair and shout the loudest to get respect and to solve problems. But also you have to win or earn is a better word. The respect to suddenly step out of the group and say, now I make a decision. And probably even more so as a woman, because, you know, when you work with very experienced men who may be a lot older than you, that comes from a history where it just was, I don't even want to discuss it. It just was more natural that it was men making those decisions. You have to just be aware that for those people that come from that time where it was unusual, you don't want to sort of hit them in the head and it just creates another issue that I don't really have time for. So I try to sort of, when you step out of the group and you've just been holding hands with everybody and sort of maybe letting the experienced men most often speak, because that's what I do as a leader. I take their advice because they know more. But when it then becomes a battle in that and you have to step out as a leader and the one that makes the decision, and you're a woman, and you may be a lot younger, it is important how you do it. And we can't, as women, just expect, oh, just the world has changed. You don't just change it over 5 years. So I'm respectful of the history. And I don't really want to argue it because it's a waste of time. History is history, but we are working on mutual respect and mutual opportunity. So, you know, I'm not fighting just women need to do everything at all. I'm fighting for mutual opportunity. If there's an opportunity, if there's a female talent and a male talent, they both need to get the interview. Then the person that's right needs to get. So we have to slowly kill that thing that, oh, the man would be better because why? But you have to respect the past. We can't change history. So a good leader, I think you have to remember who you are without necessarily using it against people. Like, now I'm a woman, I can say anything. You know, same for a man. We all have to be aware of how you present things. And I made this a long speech, but I don't spend long thinking about these things because I try to sort of just let it live in my DNA that when you step out of the group and you now have to make the decision in front of these much more experienced and knowledgeable men, you just say it in a way that is respectful. However, you're clear what the decision is.
Mm.
I think that takes practice and I'm not there yet, but it's just finger on the pulse and just trying to make it human.
You mentioned the fact that you're often the only woman at the table when decisions are made. Why aren't there more women cinematographers?
Well, it's coming now. It's really, there's a big boom and very talented people that you feel like finally, because you have asked in the past, how come that this talent of having a visual mind and creating images I mean, it doesn't make sense that men should just have a more creative mind when you have a lot of incredible female stills photographers and things like that. So it is a question you feel like, well, it can only be that it wasn't a thing that was seen earlier. I can't see any other. Of course, you can talk about being a mother and you have children, and at some point it'd be very hard if you got a 10-month-old child go like, ah, bye, I'm going to go to South Africa and shoot a movie.
Having said that, you did operate on the hunt heavily pregnant.
Heavily pregnant. I think I gave birth 2-3 weeks after that. It was crazy. It was very handy when you do handheld to just have this big bump to put your elbows on. Yeah. Luckily, I felt strong during my pregnancy. And also, I worked with the director. I actually drove up to Thomas's when I realized I was pregnant and I was meant to do the hunt. I was sort of in tears because it wasn't quite planned. And so I drove up to Thomas in his summer house and he opened the door and he said, and he looked at me and go like, are you pregnant? And I was like, what? No, yes, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, and this is what I wanted to say. It also takes people who has an open mind, because he was the one saying, why are you crying? What's the problem? Just do it and we'll figure it out if it doesn't work. There aren't that many people out there who dare to support in that sense. And that's part of changing this world. It's not just women fighting. It also means that the way people think, you know, I hate that it's become such a fight. It's a process that we have to teach people to think this way, that it isn't a problem. But anyway, to go back to you, I can't see why there shouldn't be as many female cinematographers. But I also want to say, we need to spend the time educating. You can't just change the world over 3 years or 5 years because it might come back at us if it doesn't work out. So many, many more female collaborators in the camera department all around is a joy to see.
More recently, you've obviously turned your hand to directing, having just helmed the BBC miniseries adaptation of Black Narcissus.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, having spent so much time on set and being very familiar with the life of a director, was there anything that actually surprised you stepping into that yourself?
No. I mean, I've been so close to directors and to a lot of very successful directors on set that I've seen a lot, and so I was sort of prepared for things. But if I turn around, actually being in the director's shoes has changed me. So it did. I wasn't surprised, but I think it changed me as a filmmaker doing it. So the process of actually making those decisions did change me also as a DP, because my aim has always been to support directors. But after directing, I think I realized also that in the past, perhaps I have challenged them more with the way you do things. It's timing. When do you bring things up? How much do you throw into a conversation at certain points when a director probably have something that at this point is more important, or, you know, so timing and understanding what does a director need in terms of a close collaborator, which was in Black Narcissus, myself as a DP. So it was a very, I loved doing it, and I have to admit, and I almost feel bad. I also love collaborating. It's not that I don't want to collaborate with a DP, but I think producers also got more nervous that, oh gosh, if she hires a DP and the lighting isn't what, maybe she's going to spend more time talking to the DP than the actors. And so I don't know if it was an idea that sort of came from the producers more than me, but it really worked out because I also had, the most incredible team. So I obviously, as I started the interview saying, made sure that my collaborators were the right people and they sort of completed the circle so that I could deliver in all ways.
And has that put the fire in your belly for more work as a director?
Yeah, it didn't scare me off, I rather want to say. I haven't changed in terms of, from a child, this camera and the images and seeing the world in a square frame is more about what do you exclude? What is it in this space that if you only have a frame would tell that story? And what is it you don't need to see? That idea of framing something, the rest is black. How do you go through life choosing that? That's a movie. And that's how I think. It's like, oh, if I was in this space and I know the story was this, what in the space is it would you put in this stupid frame? I mean, I know you can change the size of it, but it doesn't really matter. That is who I am. I see things in a frame. And I always know if I get into a room, it would be there, right there. Or that lighting, but that could be made there. It's just, I can't change that. It's not a choice. Not like, oh, I want to direct. I am a cinematographer, full stop. But beside that, I think I'm becoming a filmmaker. That doesn't make any less of the cinematography. It just means that I've been very lucky to have worked. I had a journey starting with Thomas Vinterberg and then Anton Corbijn, who's also an amazing stills photographer, Denzel Washington, John Krasinski, and Aaron Sorkin, and Steven Spielberg was on this side of things. I just have been very lucky to had educations every time I worked with very good filmmakers. So it's educated me as a filmmaker. And I think that's where directing, if that story is there and I can see it, I would certainly direct again. Also because as a cinematographer, I've been lucky to work with actors, as Denzel and John. So communicating with actors has been in my education from the beginning, which is part of directing. So I'm not looking for it, but if that story comes, I would definitely do it again.
Final question, Charlotta. You mentioned when you burst into Denzel's office that he asked, where did you...
who brought you up?
Who brought you up? I'm just curious now that you reflect on it from the country town, growing up with a father who's a farmer, a mother who's a hairdresser, so far away from the world of cinema. What do you feel was birthed in you from those days that has held you in good stead on a film set today?
Well, I want to put this right because it's a very important question. I'm a very naive person, not in a negative way. I don't mean it in a sort of not knowledgeable, but I'm a very spontaneous person. So I don't want to be political. That would be the opposite person who think things out and do things, because then if we do this, then we can achieve this. And I want to react to certain things. And I think where I come from, farming and the way we lived and the way I was brought up was safe, but also we lived our life in a very spontaneous way. So I think coming to the States, not knowing very much about culture over there, and certainly not the film business and Hollywood and how you talk to people and what you should do and what you shouldn't do. I never studied it, and I made a thing of not studying it, which makes you a more, well, I react to what I know. And so that's who I am. If everybody studies how you should be, then we all become the same and you won't have that energy between people. So I think in some ways I've sort of protected that naivety, because I believe people will collaborate with me more truly because I am who I am. I would talk to people the way I would because I'm a well-behaved person, but not because I was taught and somebody said here in this country, like, you are who you are. And I think we should all be that so we don't, try to be what we expect other people should be. And the same with movies. We shouldn't make movies that we think the audience want to see because we want to make more money. We want to protect the director's vision so that the audience is surprised rather than, oh, this is a trend. We're going to make another movie that looks just the same because then they want to see it. I don't think that's a way forward, neither as human beings or our movies.
That's as good a way to end as any other.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Charlotta, I really appreciate you taking the time to share your story with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Nordic Portraits is a series by me, Ben Catford. The music was composed by Nina Liu and the visual identity by Copenhagen-based studio Frame. To learn more about today's guest and all the others from this season, visit nordicportraits.net. You can also follow us on Instagram, and remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes so we can get the word out. Thanks for listening.